Hello, everybody. Welcome to this, the final episode of 2018. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, welcoming you back to Mind Shift Podcast. I wanted to get this in before the end of the year because in this episode, I'm bringing back a guest that I had on the show months and months ago, I think almost a year ago now, one Seamus Clark from Atlanta, Georgia, in the heart of the Bible Belt in the South. And of course, if you listen to the episodes that Seamus and I did, I don't know, a year ago or so, you'll recall from listening to those episodes that Seamus Clark is, of course, not his actual name. He feels that it's not really a safe thing for him to do, even all these months and months later, still to come out with his true identity and tell people who he really is. And we talked about this a lot in the podcast episodes before. It's basically to do with the fact that his wife works at an evangelical Christian ministry, and that's one of their main sources of income. And he feels like between that and the fact that his family is still staunchly evangelical, if not fundamentalist, that it wouldn't be safe for him to kind of reveal his true identity. So we've kept it as a pseudonym. Seamus Clark it is. So what are we talking about in this episode today? Well, Seamus and I mentioned this in our podcast before. He had brought up the movie The Last Temptation of Christ. We kind of touched on a little bit as something that was a really important kind of a seminal event in his life. Something that he watched when he was in film school after he left home. And we wanted to come back and touch base on this because that movie, we're going to spin out, it has a lot of implications and ramifications for a lot of areas that impact evangelical Christianity. The fact that the movie portrays Jesus having sex, and predictably the evangelicals and the Catholics absolutely freaked out. They tried to stop the movie from coming out in 1988. They did everything in their power. Once it did come out, they boycotted theaters. They did everything. They wrote letters to Universal Studios. I mean, they did everything to stop it, to protest it, to ban it, to boycott it. Why, though? Why were they so freaked out? And this is what we want to get into in this episode today, especially as it touches on this issue of what's called the evangelical purity culture. Because what we find out in doing research around this movie and why they were so rabidly protesting it and called it blasphemy and everything else, Jesus can't have sex because in both the evangelical and the Catholic world, sex is somehow related to purity and not just the idea of not having sex outside of marriage, but of course in Catholic circles, this goes to the issue of celibate priests and how chastity is such an important thing in terms of their relationship with God. It's the most holy thing. It's the most pure relationship that you can have to remain a virgin all your life. And of course, this ties into the notion of Jesus being sinless, Jesus being the perfect sacrifice. If he had sex, if he had any kind of relationship with a woman, then somehow that would taint his sinlessness and that would affect his perfect sacrifice on the cross. So it all somehow ties together. It's all part and parcel of this whole package of how I think really evangelicalism has co-opted Jesus for their own ends. And this is something that Sherry Palace and I talked about as well in our podcast. And this leads to a lot of problems, a lot of issues, and we're going to get into that in a few minutes with Seamus, talking about how the purity culture impacted him as a kid and how he got involved in a pornography addiction, which in a weird way, it's like a way around having physical sex for that evangelical kid growing up in that purity culture, but it's a double bind, and we're going to get into what the effects of this are on people, especially on us as evangelical kids growing up in this really warped and twisted system that somehow puts this veneer of Christianity, respectability, and even brings the person of Jesus into it. And I really felt that it was important to get this episode in before the end of 2018, because of course, this is the 30-year anniversary of the movie coming out in 1988. Now that this year is almost over, let's go back and kind of reflect on not just the movie itself in terms of what it did for Seamus's own process of deconstruction. It has all kinds of implications, as I say, for purity culture, for how we look at the Gospels, the story of Jesus. What does that all mean? And so we're going to get into all that in just a few minutes. But before we get to that, I wanted to give a shout out to Jill Whitmarsh. Jill is the most recent supporter of Mindshift Podcast on Patreon, and it's great to get to know her. She's just joined our closed Facebook group, so we're getting to know Jill a little bit more. Another ex-evangelical who has found the work of Mindshift Podcast and my other courses online helpful. In fact, speaking of which, I've just added the third video in my Reconstruction After Deconstruction course on Patreon. This one is called Deconstructing God. And what I do in this course is I go on from my last one, which was about deconstructing biblical inerrancy, and I show how that doctrine of biblical inerrancy and infallibility contributes to a very warped and twisted view of God. But in addition to that, there's a lot of problems with just simply the God of the Bible, and I want to show how these teachings, especially within evangelicalism, can lead to a lot of religious trauma. This is something I've been doing a tremendous amount of work on lately, something I've been posting on the Ex-Evangelical Facebook page, talking about how people suffered religious trauma when they were in evangelicalism. So I've been able to use a lot of the firsthand accounts and talking to people like Andrew Jasko last week about how this stuff sort of works its way through and how it affects people and how we're now coming out of that. At least most of us who have come out of evangelicalism, we've realized there's a lot of baggage, a lot of things we have to do to process through that stuff. So I want to help you to do that. So if you are interested in taking my course, I've got three videos up so far on Patreon. The links to that will be, as always, in the show notes. You can always contact me as well on Twitter at MindShift2018. And I will put you in touch with my content as well that way. And in fact, just from the comments that I've had from people who have gone through the three videos I've put up so far, it has proven to be a very helpful resource. Okay, so without further ado, I'm going to bring you now the conversation between myself and Seamus Clark. We're talking about Jesus Can't Have Sex, exploring the last temptation of Christ, purity culture, and more. I'm happy to be joined once again from Hotlanta, Georgia by Seamus Clark. Of course, that's not your real name, is it? We're back by almost a year later since the time we talked before. Isn't that right?
That's
about a
correct.
Year, 10 months maybe?
That's correct.
I can't remember when exactly
yeah,
we did it.
Yeah, 10, 11 months.
Yeah, and you're still going by the pseudonym. You're in the heart of the Bible Belt. If people want to
correct.
Understand your story, it's probably a good idea to go back and catch those episodes that we did 10, 11 months ago. I don't know when it was exactly now, but why,
yeah.
though, can you just run us real quickly through why do you need to use a pseudonym? Why can't you use your real name?
Yeah, just being here in the Southeast specifically, but I would say even more specifically, just my situation, my family situation is such that it's better for me to use a pseudonym because, you know, if it were to be explicitly said what my identity is or who I am, it could cause some risks in terms of like livelihood, et cetera, et cetera. So I will leave it at that.
So there's a financial cost as well as a social cost.
Possible.
And this is something,
yeah.
I've talked to a lot of people in the last, well, since we did our podcast, I've talked to a lot of people since then, had a lot of different guests on the show. And one of the things that comes across is, this whole issue of it's almost like coming out, not having that conversation with family members and friends because there's a social cost, a financial cost, an economic cost. And so you can lose relationships. And so that's a big deal. It's something you don't take lightly, is it? Especially being in the heart of the Bible Belt where you are now, it's even more
right.
a quote Christian kind of environment, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny because since then, been like, it's something to where my family and myself are becoming more outspoken, I guess, in terms of where we're at belief wise. However, it's still not, you know, official, I guess, if that's what you want to call it.
You haven't
but,
officially
you know,
come
out. Shifts in political stances, political ideologies, and even just political outlook has changed. And that's probably the most prominent place where you see it rubbing against the grain, if you will, of the people who are around us.
We talked a little bit about that last year. And again, I would refer people back to the podcast episode. I think we split it up into two. I can't remember exactly, but
yeah.
I think
yeah,
it was two episodes.
Two parts.
So yeah, people, you need to go back and listen to the one with Seamus Clark. We got into your backstory and we talked a little bit about how you're in the middle of a red state. And even now, almost a year later,
oh, yeah.
a lot has changed. politically. We had the when we're doing this recording, it's just a few days after the midterms in America, so we're waiting to see what's going to happen there. You know, there's going to be a lot of fallout come January, perhaps, because the Democrats took control of the House again. So we don't know what's going to happen. But all this somehow relates to, we talked about last time, you mentioned the movie The Last Temptation of Christ. And we've been talking about probably for 2-3 weeks about getting together and doing this episode, specifically kind of focusing on the movie. I realized just today I was doing some research on this. This year is the 30-year anniversary of the movie. It was released in 1988. Still as controversial as ever, isn't it? According to the reviews, even now, it's a polarizing movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just, it was somewhat of a watershed moment for myself when I finally saw the movie. And it's still just a lot of the themes that were covered in the film and, of course, obviously the book which came before it, just really touch on a lot of the heart of what you get into when you start deconstructing. You start trying to parse out all the different aspects of your identity as a Christian, your identity as an evangelical, the identity of Christ, the paradox of being human and God. All of those things are covered in this piece of work. So it's quite a bit to dive into and just fascinating, really, if you ask me.
It's a fascinating topic for sure, because there was a whole kind of a series of movies that came out, I guess, in the 70s and then in the 80s. I'm thinking of Jesus Christ Superstar, The Life of Brian. Of course, it's a comedy, sort of a comedy, isn't it? A Monty Python film. But along with The Last Temptation of Christ, you have these kind of three pieces that come out. And there's sort of, I guess one way to say it would be sort of a postmodern understanding of the Gospels, looking at it from different points of view. And this is one of the reasons why The Last Temptation of Christ was so controversial, because it emphasizes the humanity of Christ. So why is it such a controversial film? I mean, as a Christian, when you were a Christian, wasn't that something that you wanted to kind of understand, was the more human side of Jesus?
Yeah, so like, I would say this. Okay, growing up, you know, very fundamentalist, went to a fundamentalist independent Baptist Christian school. Of course, in church, at home, everywhere you go, you're hearing this message just getting pounded into your brain. And yeah, you hear, you know that, yes, Jesus was, the quote is, 100% God and 100% human, both. You know, perfectly divine, perfectly human. And so you heard it, but it wasn't really something that you would say, okay, I'm going to focus on this. It was always a focus on the divinity of Christ, at least in my perspective and in my experience. That's what really was the main thing. And the idea was, we're so far away and so craven and so despicable as compared to Christ. You know, sin is like filthy rags or whatever it is. I can't remember the verse, but
yeah, all of our righteousness is nothing but filthy rags in the eyes of God.
Yeah, like nothing you can do can get you anywhere close to where God is supposed to be. And so if Jesus is God, you do the math. That's kind of how it's presented. So basically what was fascinating about the film when I first saw it and kind of got into it was thinking, oh, this is a portrayal of Jesus and more of the human side of Jesus. So somebody here who I could maybe identify with a little bit more than the image of the Jesus, like, floating, you know, a foot off the ground and, you know, kind of almost like a ghostly figure. It was so far removed, like, it didn't seem anything or anybody, like, you could really touch or get to know, per se.
Certainly not
so
human,
that's
yet.
What was fascinating about the movie.
Yeah, and yet, of course, that's exactly what's so one of the reasons that's so controversial about the film is that, okay, if it's emphasizing the humanity of Christ, every Christian would admit, as you just said, that Jesus Christ was human, but they, of course, would insist that he's fully divine too. But in the film, the idea is that Jesus shared our humanity, but he did not share our fallibility. And I think that's one of the reasons where you start getting into trouble with the movie, isn't it? Because if that somehow shows him sinning, like having sex and being tempted and wrestling with the idea of whether or not he's even the Messiah, coming down off the cross and living a family life and all the rest of it, that somehow diminishes his deity, which then speaks to the sinless piece, which then speaks to the atonement piece, because he had to be sinless on the cross to atone for the sins of humanity and be the perfect sacrifice. So that's one of the major reasons why Christians, Catholics were so just rabid, hysterical about they tried to stop the movie countless times.
Yeah, so it makes you question things, which for me goes down this path. What does it mean to be human then? Like, to me it seems like to be human is to be someone who has foibles, which could be translated as one who has the propensity to sin, if you will. Although I don't really, you know, get into the whole sin piece anymore because I think that's just being human, making mistakes, quote, quote.
We all do it.
So how is Jesus human if he didn't make mistakes? Does that make sense?
Exactly, yeah. Well, but
like,
that's what they say.
How's a human, other than living in a body and breathing? Yes, that's a shared thing. But the experience of being human, the experience of having foibles, that's not allowed or that's not in the story. So I don't even know how Jesus really was human, honestly.
Well, in their construct, it's so strange because I think that's a really good point that you raise, is that the film should make you ask a lot of questions. But of course, from a conservative, evangelical, or fundamentalist, or Catholic point of
view, questions are no good.
Yeah, questions are dangerous. And so what they felt like they had to do was do everything in their power to stop the film. Actually, I read about that Scorsese actually struggled he wanted to make the film for years. But first of all, he couldn't find financial backers because they thought it was such a bad idea. And then he had a lot of opposition from Christian groups. And then when he finally got the movie together and he was going to put it out, all of these organizations, Christian and Catholic alike, boycotted the film. There was a full page ad that was taken out in the New York Times by a Catholic group called the American Society for the Defense of Tradition, Family, and Property. And they called it on the verge of public blasphemy when the movie was about to come out. They set out this open letter to Universal Studios and tried everything they could do to stop it. And, you know, they talk about that, like you say, this whole issue of the humanity of Christ. And they say, well, yes, of course he was tempted, but he never gave in to any sin. He was morally pure his entire life. He never once ever sinned, even though he was tempted like all of us are, because he was human after all. But he was fully divine. See, really.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, like, speaking of that, you know, I remember I would have been 13 years old at the time, and I remember at the dinner table one night, the boycott, we had some kind of a piece of paper passed around our table from Focus on the Family, I believe it was, James Dobson's organization. And, you know, I signed the boycott against the film. Of course, I'd never seen it. I didn't even know what I was signing, you know, yada, yada, yada. And then later, when I went off to go to film school, the first year I got out of the house, of course, I rented everything that I was never supposed to watch.
Yeah, that was
in the house.
On the forbidden list.
So I went on a tear of all Scorsese's work. And of course, I knew this was one of his films because I remember his name being attached to the boycott, but I was like, I got to see it. And the funny thing was, a girl I was dating at the time, she was in film school a couple years ahead of me and was just going on and on about the soundtrack by Peter Gabriel, which is a gorgeous piece of work, like just incredible, incredible soundtrack. So I listened to that, got intrigued, watched the movie, and was just like, this is amazing. Like, I was like, this is so good. I loved it because it showed a person wrestling with doubt, with purpose, with what am I supposed to do, with the idea of sex. I mean, it didn't really show him wrestling with the idea of sex. It just showed him, of course, in the film, in the book, really, and this is another somewhat humorous point, is that the whole Last Temptation is not about Jesus having sex, as you would have been led to believe by the boycott and by James Dobson's group and all the outrage. It's not that he had sex. The Last Temptation was for him to settle down, to get married, to have kids, and to be domesticated, and to live to be
family.
an old guy, like a regular dude.
That's what the Last Temptation is.
It's not having sex. So that's what's so funny. And I'm doubtful that anybody who came up with the boycott actually watched the film or read the book, to be honest.
Well, that's true. I read a lot of the articles about the film today, and they were saying that actually Scorsese put out a statement saying to these evangelical and Catholic leaders, he said, okay, I'm willing to talk to you. But the thing is, he was willing to have a private screening, and none of them showed up before the film was even released. And he said, look, I put it out there. You guys didn't show up. There was one guy. He was a pastor. I think it was a Southern Baptist pastor. This guy mobilized. Yeah. He was mailing out hundreds of thousands of flyers, leaflets to his parishioners all over the country. He was like a radio TV preacher, getting them to mobilize. and going to picket the theaters. And there was one of the things, Blockbuster, they wouldn't carry the movie when it came out on VHS for the same reason.
So crazy.
They wouldn't touch it.
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't carry
it. That's what's so strange is, like, you can't even engage in it. It kind of goes off the rails where the anxiety is so high that nobody will even sit to watch it so that it can be discussed.
Exactly.
Which to me speaks to this idea, especially in evangelical circles, where if you are associated with something that is deemed bad or evil or whatever, like, you can't even touch it. Like you can't even touch it or get near it. It's like you're going to burst into flames or something. It's crazy.
It's some sort of a virus. And I find that's a lot of the case with ex-evangelicals, is that when they're around people who are still within the Christian system, they treat us like we have a virus, like we're contagious, you know, we're going to infect them somehow. Like you said, there's like an anti-intellectualism, because why can't you watch the movie? What's it going to do to you? Well, that's what this Southern Baptist pastor, his problem with the movie was, he said, I got two problems. He said, first of all, it's going to discourage people who are already Christians. So it's going to damage their faith by watching the movie. And then second, it's going to drive people away who might be thinking about becoming Christians. So it's going to discourage people from becoming Christians. So he said, it's a two-edged sword here. We can't let this movie come out because it's going to stop people from becoming Christians, and it's going to drive Christians away from the faith. So they were just rabid about it.
If that's the case, then you've got bigger problems to deal with.
Exactly, yeah.
If the movie is going to cause you to lose your faith or to never enter in, then that speaks for itself right there.
How shallow is the faith to begin with? And, you know, I read another article that came out this year, and it was talking about, in the last 30 years, what's been the response from evangelicals beyond the initial, when the movie came out in 88, there was this rabid trying to stop it. Then they couldn't stop it, so they picketed theaters. In one case in Paris, in France, there was a theater that was firebombed and burned to the ground because they showed the movie.
Wow.
But in the last 30 years, they said the evangelicals have responded by putting out more movies like Mel Gibson's, you know, The Passion of the Christ, The Case for Christ, The God's Not Dead. I think there's a series of movies or shows there. So they've kind of doubled down and said, look, we need to tell the real story. I think that was a lot of the drive behind Mel Gibson's movie, wasn't it? It's like, we're going to be as accurate as possible to the Gospels rather than The Last Temptation of Christ. And so it's a rebuttal of The Last Temptation of Christ.
It's funny too, though, because a lot of the times what's so ironic and funny, I think, is that, you know, when there is big controversy, when you do boycott something, it actually generates the opposite of what they're intending, which it gives it more publicity, more exposure, more people will go see it if they're curious. It's what all the hubbub is about. And so you end up achieving the opposite of what you're going for.
Exactly.
That's just kind of funny in itself.
It attracts more people. What's the flap all about? I remember my brother-in-law, when the movie first came out, I think, well, when it finally came out in video, so it probably would have been a year or two after it had been in the theaters, and we were both in Bible college at the time, someone asked him, had he seen it? And of course, he was trashing the movie, and so was I. I mean, I was saying all these, and they said, have you even seen it? I said, no.
Yeah.
So my brother-in-law went and rented it, and I didn't watch it then, but he said, yeah, I went and sat down, and, you know, he had his pad of paper out there like, all right, I'm going to list everything that's wrong with this movie, you know. And like you say, he's going to defend everything that's wrong with it. Even though it says at the beginning, it's not based on the Gospels. It's based on a novel.
Right.
It's you know, obviously it's loosely based on the Gospel story of Jesus, but it's a portrayal of this novel by this Greek guy. I can't pronounce his name. Nico.
Right.
Nikos Kazantzakis,
I believe that's how you say it.
And I found out, too, I didn't know this, but did you know he was excommunicated by the Greek Orthodox Church for writing this book? I mean, it came out in, like, 1950, 1951.
The 50s, yes.
They excommunicated him. So
I know.
The Catholics and the evangelicals aren't the only ones who were offended by the book, even. The Greek Orthodox Church ended up excommunicating the guy.
It was interesting because I read the book years later. I saw the movie first, of course, when I was probably 18 or 19. And then I read the book when I was living in New York, which would have been like my early 20s, 23, 24. So it's something that I have followed for a while, that story. It's just fascinating. I kept revisiting it quite a bit. But what is so interesting is, like, this gets into areas of, like, purity culture, like we were talking about before. And
yes.
The idea of just, you know, sex as it is situated in the evangelical mindset, it's such an anxiety-inducing subject. It's, like, to the point of creating major dysfunction. One thing that I'll say that is, or two things real quick, little anecdotes, but, you know, when I was in school, I transferred after I didn't actually get into film school, I transferred to a local university, and in my time there, I was kind of in and out of a Christian ministry. I was always kind of on the fence about it, but at the time, towards the end, I was involved, and I had an experience where I had, you know, found freedom, quote unquote, from pornography, because that's something I struggled with growing up, again, due to purity culture and just these really polarizing ideas about sex and lust and all these kind of things. So I remember going up in front of this ministry, there's probably 400 people present, and getting up in front and saying, you know, I've been freed from addiction to pornography. And I'll tell you, it manifested in a ridiculous way there. And at the time, I thought it was some kind of a, you know, demonic thing. But now, looking back through the lens of myself being in school for therapy, for clinical therapy, it was an intense manifestation of anxiety, of college age kids' anxiety who are in an evangelical student ministry who are hearing about somebody dealing with sex and pornography. People started shaking their heads, rocking back and forth in their seats, all these crazy things, because the idea had been breached in public about pornography and sex, and like people not being able to, in a calm, just
rational way
to talk about the subject of sex.
You can't go there.
And that's what's so problematic about this, is that it's treated with such fear. Like, there's such fear mongering around it. Again, later on, when I was in New York, I had still not gotten married at this point, and I, you know, still was trying to hold out, hadn't had, you know, intercourse because you can't do that, or you'll be infected with demons or something. It was right when it was about to turn from 1999 to 2000. And this is actually one of the reasons I left New York. And this altered the course of my life in a pretty major way. But I was freaked out about Y2K. And underneath that fear was, I still haven't had sex. And so I freaked out and I was like, this can't be the end yet. I've waited. I've been faithful.
Yeah, I can't. I can't go to heaven a virgin.
It's insane, right? And so I moved out of there, and I came back to the Atlanta area before 2000. And of course, nothing happened.
Yeah, it was a big bust.
But in my mind, you know, that's the degree that this drove me to, like, just get under my skin and be in my mind, and to affect my thinking and my behavior in such a way that I would be freaked out that, you know, the rapture was going to happen, the end of the world was going to happen. I was just, you know, distraught over not getting to have sex because I had waited all this time, and I thought God would be faithful to me if I was faithful to him and all that kind of jazz.
It's true.
So
you can see, going back to this issue of the movie, how the purity culture ties into the outrage over just this image of Jesus having sex, even though, as you point out, it's actually in the context of him being married. He wasn't having sex outside of marriage. Yeah, I was talking about this full-page ad that this Catholic organization took out in the New York Times in 1988, and they said that it's an open letter, and one of the things they said was that why they wanted to stop the movie was because they say Jesus Christ was the highest ideal of moral perfection. And one of their statements is, they said, look, okay, there's nothing, this is what it says, there's nothing injurious about a man deciding to get married, but they say, to insinuate this of our Lord detracts from him. Why? They say this is because his sublime perfection assures us that he practiced the virtue of chastity, so there's your purity culture, in the most absolute way, and always maintained that state of perfect chastity, which is intrinsically superior, they say, to the matrimonial state. So from a Catholic point of view, they're saying being celibate, which of course ties into the Catholic priest angle too, isn't it? That a celibate priest is morally superior. It's intrinsically superior than someone who's married. So to say that Jesus was married and had sex it just destroys everything from their point of view. Morally, it's so wrong.
And I don't understand where this originated from, this idea of, like, sex. And then even in this case, I mean, sex in the context of marriage, I mean, what is the deal? That's supposed to be how it's the one way it's approved. But, I mean, what is the origin, and I don't know this, I would like to know, of where sex becomes, it's got such this evil or this propensity for evil or for separating you from God or not being perfect or whatever. Like, and I believe part of it has to do, if I had to guess, would be because it is such a strong desire.
Yeah, it's definitely
in our
strongest
humanity.
Drive.
I mean, it's such a deep, like, intrinsic part of being human that, and the pull is so strong that I think it probably freaks people out. It scares people because it's such a strong desire. But the thing is this, if God created us with this desire, right, if we're created, then we have it. It's supposed to be there, but of course, then they'll say, well, it's got to be within these confines, and you don't want it to get up over the banks of the river. There's some kind of a illustration where it talks about it's like a mighty river, and you got to keep it, you know, within the banks. It can't spill out, or it's dangerous. It could flood people or kill people,
destroy people, something like that.
But all that to say, I think this goes back to the idea of, like, our desires being strong, and that somehow equated with evil or with sin. And I would say that probably ties into, like, puritanical thought as well.
Yes, definitely. I think you can tie in, it goes back as far as at least Augustine, if not maybe farther, but some of the first things that were said, and it ties the fall of humanity. It blames everything on Eve, on the woman.
Right.
And so she's the one who was fooled by Satan into eating the fruit from the forbidden fruit. Then she turned around and gave it to Adam, and he ate it as well.
Right.
He went along with it. And because of that act by a woman, all of humanity has been forever tainted by human sin. And so from that point on, this is what Augustine says, we have to be super careful because the sexual wiles of women, you got to be careful. They'll lead you astray. And that's why it's so important for Mary to be a virgin when Jesus was conceived, because somehow the actual act of sex itself, the physical act, if he'd been the child of Joseph and Mary through normal human sex.
Right, he wouldn't have been human.
Yeah, he would have been human, but he would have inherited the sin nature somehow.
Right, yes.
Yeah, and
he wouldn't have been divine enough.
Exactly,
like
He could have been the Messiah, but he wouldn't have been fully God and fully man.
Yeah.
And that's why purity is so important.
To another point that we had discussed, this is one thing that I'm still deconstructing and kind of getting into, is this whole idea of Jesus as presented in the Gospels. You can see this throughout history and through how we tell narratives. We basically turn people over time into either heroes or scapegoats. And hyperbole is involved, and mythologizing and legends and whatnot all tie into it. Into making people either, you know, supernatural heroes where they're not even human, they're superhuman, they're so high above us we can't touch them,
and
it gets a little ridiculous at times. Or if they're on the wrong side of history, or they're, that might not be the right phrase, but if they're seen in a bad light, they're going to be painted as a scapegoat, and then they'll be demonized and seen as, like, super evil, and they'll turn into these almost cartoonish characters where they're nowhere near what human experience is like, which is really a mix of, quote, good and, quote, bad, a mix of just the human experience. They're either, like, high above and perfect and, you know, sinless and whatnot, or they are the worst and they're the cause of all evil. So I think what this pushes into is how we view ourselves in light of our own experience, and then tying back to the book, this is what was so intriguing about it and the movie, was seeing Jesus portrayed as somebody who you can finally relate to. Like, hey, this person's kind of like me. Like, they deal with, you know, quote, lustful thoughts, and they doubt themselves, and they, you know, wonder what their purpose is. And I mean, all the stuff that we do on a day-to-day basis, you know, as we are humans.
Well, look at the difference between that and going back to what I was talking about earlier, Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. That's sort of a rebuttal, isn't it, in many ways, of the Scorsese film, because they're showing Jesus. I remember seeing the movie in the theater. I can't remember. I think they do show him struggling a little bit in the garden. You know, he's having that moment of weakness. You know, that's the only time kind of where his humanity shines through, maybe in a little bit of a moment of weakness. But even then, he goes through it, and all the torture and the horrific. I mean, it really does kind of glorify violence in a way. You know, someone said of the movie, it's like a horror film. It's like a slasher film.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so bloody.
There's blood everywhere.
There's blood everywhere. But there was an unflinching look.
I mean, I think that pulls into, that pushes into the levels of like, you know, sin and like how much we have to be punished or how much he had to be punished to make up for sin.
Yeah, on our
behalf. And, you know, that ties into the idea of how we view heaven and hell, and sin deserves punishment. There's always a punitive edge to everything. And I mean, you see how this has shaped our whole criminal, kind of the way that we have criminal justice, especially in the United States. It's extremely punitive. So like, if somebody does something that's deemed wrong, they're put in jail and they're sent away, and there's no thought of, you know,
bringing
them back, of kind of rehabilitating people to a level of humanness. It's like they're put out with the trash. They're seen as non-human, evil, no good, get away, just go rot in jail, whatever. And that's how we view people, and that comes from this idea of the Bible and sin, and, you know, it must be punished. And ultimately, that's where you get hell from, too. You know, you sin, you mess up, you're cast into fire, you burn forever, and it's terrifying. And psychologically, of course, that's going to make people not want to go there, so you keep people in line that way. So it makes sense from that point of view. But carried to the extreme of in the afterlife, you end up either in a paradise, which doesn't sound like much of a paradise. If you think about it, for eternity, it sounds like torture. Or you end up in fire, burning forever, conscious torment.
Yeah, and that's awful as well.
So
it's the ultimate ace card.
Not so much for the afterlife.
Yeah, it's the ultimate ace card, isn't it? Someone said that, you know, hell is the ultimate punishment. It's, you can't raise the stakes any higher than that. You just can't.
Right.
I mean, what's worse than eternity in conscious torment in the flames of hell? Nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Really. And so, and that's one of the big things about being an ex-evangelical, is that there's a very real fear that what if we're wrong?
Oh, yeah.
If we repudiate these things and say, I'm not sure I believe it anymore, if we're wrong, we're going to end up in hell. That's a pretty scary thought. The stakes are incredibly high.
That's the psychological little, you know, that's the psychological hook that gets everybody. Is in the back of your mind, you're always fearing about, you know, these extreme punitive measures. And so it keeps you in line. That's how people work in brainwashing. It's always have this little doubt in the back of your mind that, you know, what if you're wrong? You better fall in line. You better do what I say. It's really manipulative.
Well, and going back to this issue of the Gospels and how it was so they were defending the Gospels, this is the true portrayal of Jesus, and the film is blasphemy and heresy. I've been reminded lately of this attachment theory. We were talking a little bit about that before we started recording, but someone turned me on to this book, The Five Levels of Attachment by Ruiz, and he starts talking about the earlier levels of attachment. But then when you get into the higher levels, level five is fanaticism. And when you actually start defending the belief system, it becomes more important than the actual being that you're worshiping, or the sports team that you're supporting, or you can attach it to anything, really. It could be sex or sports or religion or whatever. And you go beyond just talking about defending it. You actually go out and commit violence in the name of this belief that's so important. And you can see, for example, someone burning down a theater in Paris. Now you're going beyond just talking about how outraged you are. You're actually committing an act of violence in which people could have been killed. Luckily it was, nobody was hurt, but you know, they're going beyond just mere talking. Now we're actually into the level of action, acting out these fanatical beliefs because they're so hyper outraged and angry and upset about what this movie is supposedly doing.
Yeah, and it's mostly, I mean, it's just abject fear expressing itself as violence, because if you think about it, if you want to be on God's side, so to speak, you want to keep yourself as far away from, you know, what he would deem evil, so you want to show your loyalty, and so you say, I'm going to go firebomb this and destroy it because I'm on your side, because you want to let me into heaven, right?
I guess.
That's basically how the thought goes.
That's the logic.
I think in terms of behavior. Going back to just sex, because for me, like, that's what this movie was about, even as a kid, was like, oh, Jesus had sex. Horrors.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, is like, from a human perspective and from a biological perspective, you have to have sex to procreate. So there is a drive in your genetics to have sex. You know, of course, there's a lot of other, you know, facets such as the bonding of two people together with sex, oxytocin, you know, which is something that happens when two people get together and they physically touch and they're joined. So you have these neurochemicals going on. But I mean, there's a lot of research too, just about touch and about the importance of touch.
Yeah, physical touch.
And so, yeah, like even in development and development theory, it talks about the importance of touch for humans because you have to touch to help the brain to develop, to help your body to grow. So there's physiological results from touching as well. So the idea of human touch is important. And I think one thing that was interesting is that there's such a terror growing up of messing up and having sex outside of marriage that there's almost, you avoid touch because you don't want to mess up again. You had said something earlier about the wiles of the woman or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's why they can't be trusted. So, purity, yes, culture, and they have to dress modestly, and they kind of cause a man,
yes,
to stumble and everything else.
Right. Yeah. There's this fear of touch, which might lead to sin. And so everybody's kind of like just anxious over this. And especially as growing up as a teenager, you know, you get all the hormones going because you're supposed to start procreating soon biologically. And of course, back in the day in the biblical times, you know, you got married when you were what, 12, 13?
12, 13, 14.
That was pretty normal. And of course, nowadays it gets put off so much longer just because of the way we are in society with economic issues as well, because you got to have money to survive, and that gets harder and harder, especially nowadays. So you put off marriage, and there's other reasons too, not just economic, but social issues as well. But all that to say, one time growing up, I went to the movies with a friend in junior high, and these two girls were in the movie, and I remember they kept turning around and saying stuff to us like, "Hey, do you want to go back to the mall?" And they said something about like going to like the area where there's mattresses and stuff. And of course, me and my friend were kind of like, "Ooh, this is crazy."
And so I
remember going home, and I brought this up one time, and I told my mom this, which was probably stupid to begin with, but
yeah,
it did come up.
And
then she brought out the whole thing like, "Oh, beware the wayward woman who will like take you into the snares of death." And I remember I was like, "Holy shit!"
Uh-oh.
Like,
I really lost it.
Now I was like, "Oh my god, I gotta stay away from these people. They're trying to, you know, bring me into the flames of hell." So, of course, that shapes your thought as a young kid, like, you know, in terms of how you approach sex and, you know, stay away, stay pure, don't mess up. It just gets crazy how that whole thing is presented. And just the anxiety and the dysfunction that comes out of that. It's really terrible.
Well, you look at the purity culture in evangelicalism, like you were talking about pornography before. And I think for a lot of people, I've read, there's been studies on this, and I've read a lot of articles about this that talks about, because kids in this purity culture, both boys and girls, grow up, like you said, they know, quote unquote, that they're not supposed to have sex. They have to remain virgins till the wedding day. What they do is they end up going into alternatives like pornography, because they
right.
go, okay, well, this isn't technically sex. I can masturbate, but I'm not having sex.
Right.
Of course, they know pornography is wrong, but it's not somehow as bad as having physical sex with another person. But yet, of course,
right.
that brings up a whole nother layer of demons, because now you're addicted to the pornography. And so, you know, that's wrong. And so for a lot of kids,
right.
they get, both boys and girls, get trapped in yet
yep.
another thing, which is the pornography piece. And so they're tormented by that as well, but at least they're not having sex.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
That's why it's so awful, is because you really can't win. And they set you up in this, I would call it like a double bind, which is another idea
no-win.
That comes from psychology. When they first studied schizophrenia, actually, this idea of a double bind is one thing that they found that was initially thought to be the cause of schizophrenia. It's when you're told one thing, but then you're told another thing that's contradictory, and you're stuck. Like you've got this double bind and you
distance.
Can't win.
Yeah, you can't
so
win.
So what happens here is you say, you can't have sex until you get married, but you also can't look at pornography.
But you've got these huge
You're
drives.
Growing up, you've got all these hormones. Like,
exactly.
It's going to be there. It's unavoidable. It's supposed to be there.
Especially at that
so what
age.
What are you supposed to do with it? You can't win. So you get bogged down in guilt. Shame,
anxiety, depression.
You just feel horrible. You think you're going to hell. You're just mentally tortured. It's ridiculous.
Basically, what going back to the movie, it brings out the hysteria of evangelicals around the whole issue of sex, doesn't it? That's the whole point, is that when they said Jesus had sex, no way, No way. According to that Catholic document, he had to maintain perfect moral chastity, which is superior to marriage, according to them.
Oh,
being
man.
Celibate yeah. is the ideal. And so there's your purity culture right there. Jesus himself
Correct.
Modeled it for us. And that's a prerequisite for him maintaining his sinlessness, which then takes him to the cross, which then means he's the perfect sacrifice for all of humanity, and it all fits together. They cannot allow any chink in that
right.
armor anywhere. Otherwise, the
right.
whole
so,
thing falls down.
Yes. So bottom line, don't have sex, you're good to go.
And don't get into porn
funny.
Either.
Like, if that's the bottom line, if that's the place you gotta be to be morally perfect in the eyes of God, that says a lot about this framework for understanding God and for understanding perfection in terms of how this is set up. It's quite a way to control people, to have mind control, if you look at it, because if you can tap into this thing that is a biological function that is supposed to be there as a part of our humanity, the sex drive, and you can kind of control people and their behavior because of this thing, then you can really, really fuck them up that way.
You can keep them under your thumb.
Because you've got them. You know, you've got them.
You got them, and they got to keep coming back. I remember when I was a kid, I mean, you mentioned in our other podcast that you struggled with pornography when you were a kid. And so did I when I was 11, 12, 13 for probably the same kind of reasons. I was self-medicating. I didn't realize it at the time, but I knew I wasn't supposed to have sex. I got into pornography as an alternative, knowing that it was wrong, knowing that it was an addiction. But I begged and prayed and pleaded for years for God to take this desire away from me. And I'm sure you probably did this too, but he never did.
Of course.
He never came through for me. And I'm going, now, wait a minute, looking back on it now, I'm literally putting myself through hell. I know that I'm tormented. I'm just feel just terrible about myself, what I'm doing. And I know it's wrong, but I can't seem to stop. Why wouldn't God step in and take it away from me? And I begged and pleaded and everything. And I remember going to these pastors' conferences when I was in Bible college and hearing these pastors confess that they were addicted to pornography and they couldn't possibly breathe a word of it to their churches, otherwise they'd get fired. So they were coming to these pastors' conferences where it was kind of a safe place to have other pastors pray for them that they'd be delivered from their addiction. And I'm sitting there going, this is bullshit, because I know that you don't just lay hands on someone and they just, well, it's just delivered and you don't have a single temptation again.
Right.
And these guys are going back to their churches and they're going to be struggling and tormented, and yet they cannot breathe a word of it. They can't tell their wife. They can't tell the church. Otherwise, they'd be fired in a second.
Right.
And so
they can't be human.
You can't be human.
So
it's so unrealistic.
That's what's so crazy about it. That's what gives you the hook for manipulation and for mind control, honestly, because you can mess with people and keep them entrapped for years because
Absolutely.
Of this shame edge. Because just like you said, you pray and you're like, okay, I should be delivered, but you can't breathe a word of it if you mess up because, ooh, you actually are human. You messed up again. And
yeah,
so,
especially if you're
you
a
know,
pastor.
Game over for you.
Yeah,
but I think it's nuts because
it really is.
You know, I think about people now that I'm like out of this way of life I used to be in. I'm ex-evangelical, whatnot. And I think about it and I'm like, okay, look, what if I would have had sex before I got married? Nothing. Like, there's tons of people I know now who I'm friends with, and people even who were Christians who, you know, fell into sin or whatever. I mean, come on. Like, they weren't, you know, eaten alive by demons. They weren't all these things that you were told were going to happen.
Yeah, slide into moral turpitude, as they say.
It's just fear-mongering.
But it's a control system, isn't it? As you say, it's a way to keep people under control. I mean, someone said on Twitter the other day that this is the problem with religion in general, is it promises you the cure for your problems.
Correct.
But then it keeps you coming back for more. You can never be free of the system once you're in it, because you're always failing to live up to its standards. And so what actually was supposed to be good news is actually pretty bad news, because you're stuck on the treadmill.
Yes.
You're never going to get there, but the system's always promising you that it's going to help and it's going to get you there and you're going to be a better person and you're going to be this and that. And somehow it never really delivers, but it makes you feel bad about yourself.
And that's why you have to have, like we talked about before, yield cognitive dissonance just
yield
to make it all hold together.
You got to suppress that. And yet what I've found is that when you suppress your cognitive dissonance, it will manifest itself in other areas of your life. It will come out somewhere. Sure. You can't just go on and suppress it and suppress it and suppress it and be fine. No. And this goes back to the movie too, because, you know, there's a lot of questions. Like you said, it brings up these questions of the historicity of the Gospels, for example, and how accurate are they, and do they contradict each other? Most Christians have some inkling that there's some issues in there, but they've just suppressed that. I mean, I used to teach New Testament, and I went through this with my students, and I mean, you should have heard some of the defenses of the Gospels by some of these students, man. You couldn't suggest that they were contradictory. Oh no. Oh no. You had a fight on your hands, man. In our Bible college class.
You might be wrong, or somebody might be wrong. You know, egads, what would happen if you're actually wrong?
Whole thing falls apart again.
Right. And to go back earlier, too, to what you said about, you know, Augustine and blaming the woman for sin, for the fall, that, again, is a way it gets into psychological territory, but, you know, the idea of, like, projection and things like that. So if you can always look to something else, and to somebody else, and pin what you're dealing with onto them and say, you know, you're the problem, you're the one that's in the wrong. If you can always point it back, which what has happened in purity culture is that all the fault is placed on the woman. So it's not that the man has an issue. It's that, oh, you know, you're dressing a certain way. You're making me sin. It's your job to uphold my purity and my righteousness. And again, that's just projecting out and putting the onus on someone else, which is awful in and of itself.
Yeah, you hear from these women, these ex-evangelical women who grew up in the purity culture or experienced it. And I mean, their stories are just horrific, how they were blamed and shamed, and to the point where even if a girl or a young woman is raped, it was her fault for dressing provocatively. She's the one who led that poor pastor astray, because she was wearing a low cut, you know, shirt, and he saw down her shirt. And then he had to rape her.
I mean, wow.
And it's not his fault.
It's ridiculous.
It's unbelievable what the justifications, and it's all been thrown on these poor women. And you think, my God, this is all in the name of religion. This is all in the name of God, going back to the Gospels, and Jesus Christ had to be the morally perfect person and completely chaste, and he had to. And so somehow we do too.
Yeah, it's nuts.
It really is.
And so, and again, back to the film, back to the book, you know, you look at it and you think, okay, if Jesus is the person I'm supposed to model my life after, you know, first of all, according to the Gospels, he never had a family, never got married. So what do you do with that? And if he never, you know, there's nary a mention anywhere in the Gospels of any kind of inkling of sexuality of Jesus. Like, what do you do with that?
Yeah, there's
no mention. So, of course, what's the church going to do? It's going to be shrouded in misinformation, not talking about it, avoiding it. It's like the elephant in the room. But, I mean, it's because of how it's presented there. If that's your frame, you know, if that's your model and there's no mention of it, of course there's going to be dysfunction coming out of that, because it's not mentioned, but it's a major part of being a human. I mean, how do you miss that whole part of humanity?
Well, I think for people, maybe the advice is go see the film or read the book.
Yeah.
I read one of the reviews, and I think it was good. It said, the thing about the movie is that it asks more questions than it provides answers. And maybe that's a good thing.
That's what art should do.
That's what good art should do. It should provoke more questions. You can see where the two paths have gone, haven't they? Where on the one hand, the Catholics and the fundamentalists, the evangelicals, they doubled down. They protested the film. They picketed the theaters. They, in some cases, burned one down. They had letters. They did everything they could do to stop it and stop people from seeing it. Whereas on the other hand, people said, wait a minute, this is interesting, and I've got a lot of questions. I'm not threatened by this thing, and it's led them, like you, into more of an area of deconstruction. So maybe that's the advice as we kind of wrapping it up. What would you say? Go see the movie, go read the book, and
I would say watch questions. The movie. Definitely listen to the soundtrack by Peter Gabriel. It is beautiful. It's incredible. Listen to the soundtrack, read the book by Nikos Kazantzakis, watch the movie by Martin Scorsese, and just, you know, sit in it for a while, ask some questions, let it shift your perspective. Because, you know, like we all know, in fundamentalism, you always go towards certainty. Questions are forbidden, but really that's what makes good art. And that's why a lot of the, you know, modern evangelical art is such shit, to be honest, because it's all about being certain and having things with a nice little bow on top. Airtight. But where you get into the real good stuff is where you don't know. There's uncertainty. There's questions. And you really dig more and you ask more why than anything else. And that's where you need to be.
That's where you need to be. You got to ask more questions than provide answers. Because as we know, there's not a lot of answers out there. I think that was one of the things when I was an evangelical that, like you said, the certitude was something I really, really prized, you know, and being a pastor and being a teacher, it does kind of stroke your ego when people come up to you and they go, oh, I got a question about this Bible verse, or can you tell me what this means? And theologically,
you're the expert.
And you're the expert, man. You went to Bible college, you went to seminary, blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, I do know a lot. I do know a lot about the Bible. I do know a lot about theology. I did study this stuff for years, man. I taught it. And so you feel pretty good about, and you think I'm helping them. I'm soothing their fears. I'm giving them the answers. And, you know, now I look back and I think, wow, I could see why I thought I was doing all the right things for all the right reasons, but now it's like, wow, you know, I got a lot of questions, man. And I'm not sure there's a lot more answers out there.
Right. Cause just life is, you know, there's just a lot of unknowns. Your experience kind of testifies more than anything else that could give you any kind of certainty or answers, to be honest.
That's true. And we're on this journey wherever it goes. I mean, I'm glad that we touched base again. We didn't really get into much of what's changed in your life, but I think if people do want to get a hold of you, what they can do is get a hold of me and then I can put them in touch with you. So I would say if you want to hear a little bit more about your life story, we've said it before, go back and listen to those two podcast episodes. You can kind of get a little bit about Seamus Clark, that unknown Irishman from the buckle of the Bible Belt. Well, thanks, man. Thanks for being on this show again, coming back and really kind of tweaking our brains around this idea of all the themes in this movie. I think it's been a really interesting discussion. Hopefully it'll help people kind of unpack some of their stuff. So I know you got to get in and have dinner. So thanks for hanging out with us, Seamus, man. You take care, and I'm sure maybe we'll meet again in another year and see where we're at then.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, not a problem. Thanks for being on the show.
You got it, man. Thank you.
I don't know about you, but I find it absolutely fascinating, mainly to watch the reactions of evangelicals, and I have to say Catholics alike, as we talked about. In the last 30 years, what was their reaction, first of all, in 1988 when the movie came out? They absolutely freaked out, and we explored all the different connections between purity culture and the effect, the religious trauma, the use of the Gospels, and how evangelicals and Catholics, fundamentalists, could not handle any sort of what they perceived as an attack on the Bible, an attack on the person of Jesus, and that includes, of course, this idea that Jesus himself might have had sex, and what does that mean for the purity culture? And you can see the reactions. They absolutely freaked out at the time. And over the last 30 years, what has been their response? Well, it's the predictable sort of thing. It's a doubling down. It's coming out with movies like The Passion of the Christ and God's Not Dead and The Case for Christ. And of course, innumerable books and so forth on subjects like the reliability of the Gospels. And if you look into the issue, just for example, of the purity culture in evangelicalism, it is a huge movement right across certainly North America. It's not so big here in Great Britain where I live, but it is massive and it has caused a tremendous amount of psychological, sexual damage, emotional repression, sexual repression, on and on and on. I've heard from numerous people who have been seriously affected by the purity culture movement, and that all ties in back to this person of Christ and the sinlessness of Mary, and it's all somehow related to Orthodox Christianity. And as I've said many times before, it's sort of like a house of cards. If one card is taken out, the whole thing falls apart. So of course they have to defend all of it, every part and parcel, every piece, every bit of it has to be defended to the hilt. It is absolutely a hill worth dying on. So I hope this has been a helpful discussion for you between myself and Seamus Clark, kind of unpacking some of the issues around not just the movie, but the implications to Christianity that have arisen as a result of this movie and things like it. So I hope that's been a helpful discussion. Now, I wanted to say, I mentioned before that this is the last episode for 2018. Next year, what's coming up on Mindshift Podcast? Well, I've got some great guests already lined up. I'm going to be talking to Blake Chastain of the Ex-Evangelical Podcast. I've also got an interview with Andy Pakula. He's a pastor of a non-religious church here in London. So that is going to be an interesting discussion. We're going to be doing that sometime in January. I also want to get into issues around the LGBTQ community and how specifically the hashtag Church2 ties into that. There's been a lot of stuff that's gone on right near the end of the year with the GC2 summit, talking about how evangelicalism is supposedly looking at this issue of sexual abuse and sexual harassment within evangelical churches. So we're going to dive into that topic, hopefully in some really great detail in 2019. Also, I've been doing a tremendous amount of research and writing and talking to a lot of people on the connection between evangelicalism and the world of cults. And it might surprise you to find out that many of the people who have left evangelicalism, fundamentalist Christianity, exhibit a great many of the exact same psychological and sexual problems that people who come out of cults display as well. So I'm going to be doing a lot of work, I think, in the new year on this topic as well. I want to talk to people who have come out of various cults, so I'm really excited to dive into that topic. I've also got an interview lined up with the guys from the Pilgrims and Prodigals podcast, which I've been on a couple times this year. So it is their turn to be my guests on Mindship Podcast. So I'm really looking forward to talking to those guys. I will also be adding every month a new module to my Reconstruction After Deconstruction online course, which will be available on Patreon. So at some point, I don't know how many videos there's going to be in this course, but I've already got 3 so far. So every month I'm going to be adding a new one. And if you want me to talk about a specific topic, either in that course or on this podcast, please get a hold of me. I can be found on Twitter at MindShift2018. That's probably the best way. Follow me there. You can message me. You can also look me up on Facebook, the MindShift Podcast Facebook page. Send me a message there. So thanks for joining me in this year, 2018. We're going to come back in January of 2019 with some fantastic content. Thanks for coming along with me on this journey, and I will see you all back here in 2019, right here on MindShift Podcast.